It's time for City Visions with your host, Victoria Thorpe.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I am Victoria Thorpe, sitting in for Joseph Pache. Our topic tonight is foraging fever. According to some Bay Area foragers, the hills are alive with a great big salad, or at least the chanterelles for your gourmet pizza. Foraging is the process of searching for and gathering food and provisions from wild sources. In the Bay Area, people are foraging for everything from the weeds growing on a median strip to the chickweed and nettles in our regional parks. Foraging has a long history in this region, as the Ohlone and Coast Miwok peoples have been actively managing Bay Area natural resources in a cycle of hunting, fishing, and gathering for millennia. But now, as growing numbers of people begin to explore foraging for food, textile dyes, and more, what does this movement mean for these cultural and historical traditions? What is fostering the foraging movement? Is it a commercial enterprise, the latest food trend, or a way to opt out of the industrial food system or build community? In a region of 7.2 million people, how are groups from foraging aficionados to park rangers negotiating together in the service of ecological stewardship? And what are some of the legal and ethical questions that foraging raises for parks and your own backyard? Tonight, we will discuss these questions and more with our guests and your listeners. Joining me in the studio for this conversation are two local foraging experts. First, we have, by phone, Kevin Feinstein. Kevin is a naturalist, writer, and teacher who advises and organizes classes for Forage SF and offers private classes and workshops on his own. Kevin maintains his website, feralkevin.com, about foraging food and natural health, and is co-author with Mia Adler of The Bay Area Forager, your guide to edible wild plants of the Bay Area, and the author of Crash Course in Wild Mushroom Foraging. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you, Victoria.
And here in the studio, we have Sasha Dewar. Sasha is the founder of the Permaculture Couture Institute, an educational nonprofit supporting regenerative design for fashion and textiles based in San Francisco. Sasha is a textile artist and designer who is reviving seasonal and local plant-based color and is the author of the Handbook of Natural Plant Dyes. She is also a professor at the California College of Arts, where she develops curriculum in the intersection between slow textiles and social practice. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you both for being part of City Visions Radio tonight. At about 20 minutes after the hour, we will start taking calls from our listeners at 415-841-4134, or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or send us a message on our Facebook page. Okay, we're going to start by diving into this whole topic of foraging, which I think is so fascinating. But many of our listeners might be wondering, what is foraging? What are these people talking about? And I also want to get into some of the nomenclature, because some people call it collecting, harvesting, gleaning. And we want to know what's the difference between modern foraging compared to some of those ancient traditions that come from Native American people. So I'd like you to each talk about what you would describe as foraging and what are the sort of things that in your world you forage for, and describe a little bit about your work in this area. I think we'll start with Kevin and then go to Sasha.
Thank you, Victoria. Foraging, what does that mean? I mostly think it means just gathering food, harvesting, like all the things you said. Foraging lately has been the more sexy buzzword for that practice. And often people conjure foraging as out, you know, in the remote wilderness, gathering mushrooms or some edible greens. And that's the same way that you would say, you know, a farm is, you know, a red barn and a cow and a field. Those are sort of iconic cultural images, but foraging really is just gathering food that, you know, is grown with little inputs from humans. So I wouldn't call foraging, you know, harvesting a monoculture of corn that's, you know, 300 acres by a tractor. That's not foraging. But, you know, on the human scale, going out and interacting with food as an ecological member, that's what I would call foraging.
So if someone were to be walking by an orange grove and pick oranges out of a tree that was cultivated to be an orange tree, is that foraging?
Sure.
Okay.
You know, so there's no hard definitions for these things. I would say that was foraging. But, you know, if you were coming through with, you know, giant machinery or whatnot, then possibly not. That's a little bit stretching that definition.
Okay. And is there anything important for us to know about collecting, gleaning? Are those feel like important distinctions in your mind?
Collecting, collecting like comic books. Now, I'm not really, I mean, collecting food, gathering food, harvesting food, all those seems very similar to me in my mind. As far as gleaning, though, there's a distinction that's usually made there. Gleaning is often just the leftovers from, let's say, an orchard, for instance, like you were describing. If there's leftover oranges or apples from, you know, an orchard operation or a farm, you know, coming through and getting what remains would be considered gleaning.
Okay. All right. So that's very helpful. But it's also helpful for our conversation to have that wide umbrella of a definition. Sasha, I know your work is in a slightly different area of foraging, if you will, and I'd welcome you to call it something different if you want. Would you describe for us what you do and how that relates to this whole movement?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that Kevin hit on some great points regarding the definitions of foraging and gleaning and just the participation aspect that I think it is. It's so important for me and my definition of foraging to have that participation of people and plants kind of working together. And a lot of my work revolves around community resources and also being able to understand the systems and cycles of a year and how one might participate in gathering materials for plant dye or fiber or food, all in the same sense. So if that makes sense. And then also continuing that definition of gleaning and foraging for byproducts of color by looking at, maybe onion skins in the Berkeley Bowl bin that may not go to use in another sense, but could become gorgeous colors. And again, thinking about street foraging for liquid ambar leaves that can also become color as well.
So it's really being super creative about thinking where all of these resources may lie beyond your work. Sounds like it goes beyond forest to looking at, things that are left over that you
absolutely
can turn into different things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of your work has to do with textiles, that's right.
Yes, but also with food. I collaborate quite often with those who work in food and those who work in medicine as well, because it's looking at the whole plant and in a systems thinking perspective, what are byproducts of a meal, especially if you've gone through the trouble of foraging or gleaning or even harvesting the most seasonal ingredients. It's a lot of time and energy that goes into that. So working with your community and being able to have a gorgeous meal and then gorgeous color byproducts from that meal, from the waste products, perhaps like artichoke leaves instead of, or the, leftover parts of a avocado, like the avocado pit, you could still use to make color.
So not only do you eat your meal and you get to wear it later.
Absolutely,
I love
yeah
that. Okay. Is there anything, I would just ask this question to either one of you, is there anything particularly unique about the foraging movement in the Bay Area? I mean, are we in a hotbed of this as we are for many sort of food, movements? Is the Bay Area a particular place for this? Is this going on around the country? What's special about the Bay Area in this?
Well, I would say what's special about the Bay Area is what you said, that it's consistently been over the years a hotbed of the foodie movement. Slow food, locavore, all of those upcoming food movements and ones that have been going on for a long time have been based out of here largely. And I think it's no different with the foraging movement. I don't think the Bay Area is particularly good for foraging wild things as the East Coast is, but our growing season, our ability of fresh ingredients is pretty much all year. And that also contributes, I think, a lot to valuing fresh greens and fresh fruits and things that you might even be able to get in the winter where otherwise you couldn't. But I still think it's primarily, it's cultural. It's a cultural hotbed with lots of brilliant people that are concerned about what's going on, and foraging movement's no different.
Okay. Sasha, anything you wanted to add there?
I would just like to add that the perspective in terms of biodiversity and diversity that the Bay Area has to offer on many levels, including socially, culturally, environmentally. There's a lot to explore there. And for instance, we held, through Permaculture Institute, we held a workshop yesterday that focused on tasting 18 different types of citrus in the middle of winter. Mm-hmm. It was a winter workshop, and then also nice. Looking at colors that were available and variety, including from citrus peels. So the more that we eat and the more that we experience kind of diversity, there raises questions, and I think that the Bay Area is really good at exporting ideas. And so for that sense, you know, there's a lot of experimentation going here. And not to say that one way is mm-hmm. right or wrong, but there are issues that emerge in that experimentation. And I think in some ways the rest of the world is looking towards us in the Bay Area to provide, you know, some ideas.
And I think that's been mm-hmm. you know, been true in the Bay Area for many years, especially in the food area, in many areas. I like to look next at, and we're kind of going there, but this whole, how the foraging movement is growing, it seems like it's kind of exploding in popularity right now. And I know, Kevin, you lead foraging tours, and so maybe you would be someone, and it sounds like, Sasha, you have a pulse on this too. Talk a little bit about the people who come to you or come into your website, coming to you. Who are these people who are interested in foraging? You know, what are they? And maybe give us a little sense of why. You know, is it economic? Is anybody out there looking for food for economic reasons? Or is it, you know, as we were just talking about, sort of the foodie people, you know, and maybe just describe what you're seeing in this kind of growing movement. Who's doing it and why?
Okay, it's a great question. I've been teaching wild food walks and classes on foraging for many years, and it used to be not too long ago a pretty fringe thing that only a certain group of people that you might call like hippies from Marin, jokingly, would come to. And my classes were sparse and, you know, like I said, there's a very limited population. And then the economy crashed. And after that, whether it's just coincidence or not, it got exponentially more popular, and my classes, you know, became full, and now that's, you know, what I do as my profession. All since, you know, 08, 09, when the economy tanked. So I don't get a lot of people in my classes specifically looking to save money or whatnot, but they often will joke about, I'm interested in knowing what I can eat in the case of the zombie apocalypse. I do get that exact statement quite often.
We could have a whole show about the zombie apocalypse, but
yeah, and I think that it's just a general interest in more food, like taking, you know, our interest in food to the next level, and you know, becoming, I want, you know, the most local possible, the most natural possible, the most nutritious, and those wild foods fit those categories very much. I think that's a big part of it. Why people are just, like I said, you know, coming to the classes. So I'm Victoria. I'm sorry. What was the other part?
Well, I kind of wanted to know, who is it? So you kind of give me a little bit of the why, although we're not sure how this is. It seems like it's exploding for a lot of different reasons, maybe related to the economy, and maybe people just have, you know, more time or something. But also, who are these? I mean, are they young people? Are they, you know, baby boomers? Who is it that's coming out and interested in learning about this?
I just want to clarify. I've certainly not met a single person that's got more time. So it's people of all ages. There's a lot of people that maybe work in an office, you know, for a computer company, you know, many, many hours a week, and then just need more of a nature connection. And they're interested in food and, you know, fun events, and it is trending in a way. And then, you know, you hear it word of mouth. So I get all sorts, all ages. I get kids, you know, middle age, elderly, people come to the classes and, you know, just want to know what's out there. You know, it's just fascinated by the idea that there's food growing all around us and they didn't even know about it. I get a lot of chefs, people that are interested in unique culinary experiences, as well as people that just want to, like I said, get out in nature and just connect, just be a part of their ecosystem, at least for an afternoon.
And what are some of the main things that you take people foraging to find? I mean, mushrooms seem like maybe a category. What else is out there that people might be surprised to hear is available if you look hard enough?
Well, I want to clarify that most of the classes that I teach, we're not actually going out and foraging food. Instead, they're wild plant identification walks or, you know, mushroom walks. We do go on mushroom forays. I largely do those through Forage SF. And we will go to a somewhat remote location and actually pick wild mushrooms. But as far as, you know, things that we learn about, like right now, the hills are alive with food. And, you know, we have miner's lettuce with chickweed and cleavers and cardoons, wild mustard.
Okay, I'm just going to stop you there. What's cardoon? Help us understand what some of those words are you just used. Are those types of greens? Okay. Are they...
Miner's lettuce is a type of green, as well as chickweed, and cleavers is a tea or a edible green. You know, wild mustard, you can use those as just, you could turnip greens or mustard greens cooked or raw. Cardoon is basically the stalk of a wild artichoke plant that you peel and then cook. And it's traditionally done in Europe and still is foraged for there today.
That sounds delicious. Okay. What about you, Sasha? What are you seeing? Thank you, Kevin. That's really helpful. Got to kind of lay of the land there. I guess, pardon the pun. What are you seeing, Sasha, in terms of people coming out? And you're teaching classes, too, in this whole area, right?
Yes.
So who's interested in the classes you're teaching? And why do you think they're interested?
Well, I think beyond, you know, working with a lot of art students who are looking towards alternative methods of creating color and wanting to have a deeper connection to their materials, I work a lot with those who are interested in slow food and want to see overlaps into other areas, slow, quote, areas of their life, including materials, clothing, et cetera. And I work with a lot of designers who are, again, like what Kevin was mentioning about, you know, techies working on their computer all week, but designers also are techies in a sense, mm-hmm. working on their computers all week, and they don't have that nature connection either, and they really do want it. So oftentimes it will be, you know, senior textile designers from some big companies in, you know, both here in San Francisco, but in other areas of the country too, who are interested, or people will even come up from LA. And they're just really interested in kind of this flip side of fashion. And, you know, especially with Greenpeace is launching or has been launching a big campaign against the environmental atrocities of what is known as fast fashion. And it's true. There are a lot of chemicals in our clothing. And I think people also, you know, as the economy has crashed and, you know, they're looking at where their money's going, and they're also getting more information at the same time, ideas of doing things themselves, or at least appreciating where things come from, or trying to understand how to even maybe rewrite the system, in case of designers working for bigger companies, or even independent designers, which there are of a lot of in San Francisco, and the way that you might approach this age-old process of dyeing, which plant dyeing, which has been around as a byproduct of cooking and creating medicine for a very long time, and these recipes have just been quite dormant, so... there's a lot of experimentation happening.
It's so interesting. And you both raised, you know, Kevin, you mentioned chefs, and Sasha, you mentioned designers. What I'm curious about is the sort of commercial element of some of the foraging that's going on, and that I've heard of, you know, people, restaurants that are serving food that's been foraged, or it sounds like, you know, designers who are looking to maybe do this at a bigger scale. Are you seeing that, you know, so this, are you seeing a commercial element of this where people are going out and gathering things that are for not just their own purposes, but for, you know, repurposing into something to sell at some level? And what's the impact of that? It sounds like that would create maybe a bigger scale operation.
Absolutely.
At some level.
Yeah.
Do you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Well, that's a big question. I mean, also specifically because plant dyes work so differently than synthetic dyes. And, you know, plant dyes are also really focused in on, you know, type where that plant comes from. The colors are often very unique according to season and time of year, and also even soil alchemy. So it's really difficult to, you know, to have scalability on the current fast fashion track mm-hmm. that we see. So there's a lot of ideas kind of in terms of philosophy as to how fashion should be approached. And then in terms of what might be scalable, some of the more experimental things with gleaned, quote, items in you know, in the industrial system already, or working in collaboration with food. So for instance, you know, hop waste from breweries or avocado pits from Mexican restaurants mm. for smaller designers, and creating a community. You know, you also have to know as a designer, or if it's commercial, that you're going to be able to get that material.
Yeah, to get that, to source that.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Or else it needs to be, I mean, the stewardship has to be extremely in line
yeah.
to make it work too. And it can't be exploited. I mean, mm-hmm. that's another part. It just almost doesn't even work on that level.
It sort of defeats the purpose then, right?
Defeats the yeah. purpose, yeah.
Kevin, what about the commercial element for the food foraging movement? What are you seeing there?
Well, I've yet to really see anything be overpicked. Like I've been saying throughout the years, the opposite is true, that things are vastly under-harvested. That being said, this year especially, mushroom foraging locations are overpicked. Not because the mushrooms themselves necessarily are overpicked, but because where people are allowed to go forage for them has added pressure on it, because there's only a few places where it's allowed. And so then they've been overpicked. And, of course, overpicking mushrooms is a whole other story than overpicking plants. For the most part, picking a mushroom does not, you know, hurt the long-term fruiting of the mushrooms, because it's just the mushrooms are just the fruiting body. And they're going to just rot basically anyway. It's like picking an apple off of a tree. So, and a lot of things that are, you know, very valuable to me as a forager haven't really caught on yet in the restaurant trade, such as thistles. Thistles are one of my absolute favorite things to forage for locally, and they're in huge abundance, and I would say virtually none of them are being foraged for. Nettles, which, you know, are often foraged for restaurants over the years, they're still popular, but nettles grow extremely fast, and it only takes a few nettle patches to supply some, you know, high-end restaurants. So it's something that's always on the radar, and it's something I'm looking out for, but yet I've yet to really see any overpicking of anything locally. In the East Coast and some other parts of the country, you know, there are some old-growth items like ramps, wild onions and things that grow a little more slowly that are coveted by the you know, chefs, and they can be overpicked. I think anytime you start looking at nature as a commodity to just be packaged and sold, then you get into trouble. One of the main reasons that I got into what's being called foraging is to use the surplus of what nature is providing. So I love it, Sasha, how you were saying the onion skins from the bins and the brewery waste and things like that being used for good purpose. That's kind of the way I see things all the time in the foraging world. It's mm-hmm. right now the hills are producing, you know, tons of miner's lettuce. How can we pick the miner's lettuce without, you know, taking away from next year's miner's mm-hmm. lettuce crop? And so someone that maybe has a monocultural agriculture background, when they're just, you know, they're pumping it with, you know, fossil fuels in order to get the yield and then take it to the market, and, you know, every dime counts because, you know, that's very low wages being paid for all of that industry. You know, once that starts to get into wild foods, then they're going to diminish rapidly, you know, in their number. However, most of the things that I teach are considered to be, you know, invasive weeds. So they're things that are going to keep coming back, probably despite our best effort to eradicate mm-hmm. them. So overpicking is not an issue when it comes to that. So, it, you know, it really is a matter of which plants you're talking about, where you're talking about picking them from, and how you're looking at the plants as far as commercial use. So to me, commercial use would be, you know, foraging nettles from a wild spot that I have and selling them at a, you know, decent price to a restaurant to be used, you know, sparingly to enhance the culinary, you know, value of the meals that they serve. And then if you look at, you know, commercial harvesting is that, you know, we're going to just package it up and sell it at the supermarket. You know, that's a whole other discussion.
Right, and that, I guess, would veer away from foraging anyway once you start with that, because you'd have to start cultivating it. I want to just stop for one, or just jump in for a second with Jonah Raskin, who you guys might know, one or two might you might know. He's a longtime forager, and he's written many articles on this topic, and he couldn't come on the show for the entire hour, but we thought it might be helpful to have him come on. And as we're talking about this whole growth of the foraging movement, who's doing it, why, maybe have Jonah discuss a little bit about what he's seeing. Jonah, are you there?
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Yes, so I've been out with the idea of foraging half a dozen times over the last couple of months, and in Sonoma County and Mendocino County, and with longtime foragers. And we have seen almost no mushrooms at all. No chanterelles, and which in other years are abundant. And the people I've known who go out foraging say the same thing, that there are no chanterelles this year. And people feel that it's because there was no rain in January. So that the weather had an effect on it, people also tell me that who go to Salt Point, that Salt Point is just, it's a place where you can legally get mushrooms, but which means that so many people go there that everything has just been trampled down. You've got dozens and dozens of people who are going in there and just packing down the earth. And the other aspect that's going on is that there are chefs who in Sonoma and Glen Ellen and Santa Rosa who are going out looking for mushrooms and just scooping them all up and so that they can't come back in future years. So to me, it looks to me like, just based on this year, a pretty dire situation. I don't really see people being ethical about foraging. I see people kind of abusing it. I see people who are trespassing, going on other people's property and trespassing to gather mushrooms and not caring about where they go or what they do. So to me, it's very distressing.
Okay.
That's what I see.
Jonah, thank you so much for adding your point of view. And it sounds like you're somebody who's had such a long lens on this. It's really helpful.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in.
Okay.
I think Jonah introduced a topic that I'd like to turn to next, which is about the legality of foraging. And I know, Kevin, you mentioned that you don't take people into parks and say, let's all go pick things.
Definitely not.
And I'm sure, Sasha, that's not your activity either. But the reality of it is that it seems like there's not really a legal place to do this, from what I can understand, or maybe very, very limited. And so I guess, you know, what do you tell people? Like, what's legal? What could, you know, if someone comes out of the show really interested in foraging, where would they go to do that? And what are the risks somebody takes in going into their local park or open space to look for miner's lettuce? Let's just use that as an example.
Well, the place that you're allowed to forage is land where you have permission to do so. As far as I know, there are no laws against foraging. It's just you're not supposed to take things from land that you don't have permission to take them from. So anybody that has any of their own property or their neighbor's property and they have permission to go foraging on that property, then it's no problem. However, you know, that's not accessible to many people. And I feel that we're almost confusing the matter a bit when we're combining mushrooms with plant foraging, because they're very, very different things. I agree that Salt Point, I've noticed for the first time this year that it was overpicked, as Jonah had indicated. But I haven't noticed any ecological problems locally, if even as far as Salt Point, from the foraging of mushrooms. It's just there's no more mushrooms to pick. So someone who has been picking mushrooms in an area for many years, and then they're no longer available for that person, that really sucks. But not to be confused with, like, overpicking, you know, rare native bulbs that drive them to extinction. Those are completely different ideas and topics and things that are happening. So as far as going into the local parks and foraging for these things, it's not allowed to forage for plants in any park that I know of. It is allowed to some degree in national forests, often with permits, but the closest national forest is many hours away from the Bay Area. So unfortunately, there aren't any places at all that allow plant foraging per se. A few places will allow like picking fruits off of trees, like old orchards, historic sites, where there might be some old pears and things like that. A few of those places allow it. Theoretically, if fruit is hanging over into like a public sidewalk, like from a fruit tree in the city, you're allowed to pick that fruit according to most local laws in various little towns and municipalities, you know, around the Bay Area. So, do you have any more questions about that?
No, that's pretty clear that pretty much is illegal. But that there are places to do it that are legal. And just to understand this, if I'm getting this correct, are mushrooms considered not a plant, and that's why they might be in a different category? Is that?
No, mushrooms are certainly not plants. Mushrooms are more they're more related to animals than they are plants.
Right.
But
so does that make them
the mushroom
legal?
Is just the mushrooms are the fruiting body. And so it's similar to picking that apple off a tree.
Oh, I see.
Sometimes
okay.
Allowed. And only a few places will allow it, such as Salt Point.
Okay. Okay.
And
so
a few
that's
other
the
state parks do allow mushroom picking because it's generally considered to be, you know, a normal human activity in many countries. And, you know, we have people that come over from Europe and they're in my classes and I tell them that, hey, you can't just go picking mushrooms. They're shocked, you know, because a lot of places, countries in Europe have, you know, laws where you can just, like free roaming laws. Where you can just go to someone else's land and just pick without, you know, thinking about it because it's like a normal human thing to do. You know, that gets you in trouble with private property for sure. But it just kind of convolutes that whole matter with the mushroom foraging, you know, tradition as being just, you know, you go out and pick it and it's no big deal. Another thing about mushrooms is they're far more valuable and on the market and, you know, to the chef. And to the forager, as far as a nature experience, I mean, there's very little out there like roaming around, you know, a mature forest, you know, with your nose to the ground, looking for porcinis or chanterelles or matsutakes and things like that. It's just an extraordinary experience that is just way more highly coveted than just plant foraging.
Okay.
And it's more of an experience than I would say it's gathering food.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that completely makes sense, and I could see that, and there's also value, there's literal value in some of those mushrooms. I'm going to ask Sasha to jump in just a minute. I'm going to want to just invite your listeners to join this conversation. Tonight we're discussing the foraging movement in the Bay Area with our guests. We have Kevin Feinstein, who's a naturalist, educator, and co-author of The Bay Area Forager, Your Guide to Edible Wild Plants of the Bay Area, and Sasha Dewar, who's a professor, author, and founder of the Permaculture Institute. And I would love to hear from any of our listeners who've ever tried foraging for food, if you've been interested in foraging for food, and what you want to know about this interesting food movement, or textiles, or anything else that you've gone out and gathered for. Our number to call in is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post messages on our Facebook page by going to Facebook and searching for City Visions Radio. So, Sasha, we're talking a little bit right now about the legality of this whole foraging movement, and I'm wondering if you've encountered any sticky wickets in that department in your work.
Absolutely. And what I would like to add in on this is... just on this topic with legality and social practice, per se, which is a big part of the work that I do at the California College of the Arts, and also in my own work with Permaculture Institute, it's a lot about forming relationships, and that's a relationship with people that may be keys to helping you get that material, and also having an experience or a kind of a stewardship towards keeping a regenerative design process in line in the way that you gather or harvest or forage for materials. So I am just thinking of an example of this, which is for the CCA campus in Oakland. With my students, I teach a course, an undergraduate course called Soil to Studio, and with my students in our first class we taught, which was in 2008, and with the help of the Botanical Garden at Berkeley, the UC Botanical Garden at Berkeley, we tagged over 150 plants just on the Oakland campus that would provide color or fiber, and then we created a map. And so it was a walking map of just a normal environment. Many of these plants are normal plants for the Oakland, urban environment as well. And it was very strongly encouraged to not have the students then start pillaging the campus because
it's
a public place,
right? Yeah.
And there are students and they want free materials. Mm-hmm. So within that is that sense of deepened eco-literacy, but also stewardship and, kind of understanding that these plants have these potential, but they are not to be pillaged for. Mm-hmm. And so within that process, after creating that map and, helping to kind of raise awareness to a normal walking experience that has this whole other level to it, it's also became, obvious that it made sense to become friends with facilities on campus and to create relationships when, branches are coming down of certain trees and to know when those are happening and to have that communication between students and facilities. And it saves everybody work and energy in the sense that there's communication between people and in that stewardship of, looking at what's happening on mm-hmm. campus. And then beyond that, it's it also encouraged us to start a garden, too, for those who did want to harvest in mm-hmm. one place. So we have a garden on campus. And then it's also looking at things like weeds or invasive plants that come into the environment anyway, or that there's overabundance of. And then, again, organizing and communicating amongst people as to, how and when to remove those, quote, weeds, even mm-hmm. though weeds are very useful for food and for color and for fiber, et cetera. It's a little bit of tending towards one's ecology and tending towards one's practice.
So it sounds like a combination of educating people and also encouraging people to realize that it's with the relationships. It's not an adversarial experience.
Absolutely.
It's a matter of working together, that there's vested interests on both sides.
Yeah, and also, encouraging an individual to work together with a plant, too. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to take that on yourself and maybe forage in an urban environment where you're in a median in the middle of the road and there are weeds there, it's understanding, how can you take those weeds and not spread seeds to some other place?
Mm-hmm.
Or how then could you help prune a tree that maybe isn't getting pruned in the right way and use those prunings or use, parts of that tree that are edible, et cetera, to then create mm-hmm. value for your work from
it's
that.
A sophisticated enterprise, it
yeah.
sounds like, in
yeah.
some ways.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a caller on the line I'm going to go to in just 1 minute. We did get a statement from the East Bay Regional Parks Department. They did not choose to come on the show, but they just wanted to make sure people know that, that they ask people not to forage in public lands, and they work hard to balance public usage and education programs with protection and preservation of natural and cultural resources, and that collecting without a permit for economic benefit is not permitted. And that people have been seen collecting mushrooms in large bags, and that they, see that as a fairly destructive activity, as you all have both agreed. One thing that's very interesting we spoke about in the introduction to the show is that the history of Native American people with foraging in what wasn't considered foraging then, but just living off the land before there was agriculture and grazing. And we have a caller who is from the Chumash tribe, I believe, and And Rosie, are you there?
I am.
We'd love to hear your point of view on this whole movement and how it fits into some of the historic traditions that come out of Native peoples.
Well, let me introduce myself. My name is Rose Ramirez. I'm of Chumash descent. I am not a member of a tribe, a federally recognized tribe. I'm a California Indian basket weaver, and I'm on the board of American Indian Channel, and gathering foods, materials, medicines are part of our daily lives. And I do appreciate some of the comments I heard earlier about not necessarily taking people out when you have classes and just taking them out into the woodlands, because that is, I think, one of our concerns is we do a lot of education. We like to teach about what Native people used, are still using, and, you know, gathering, and their concern for the, you know, the environment. And we definitely don't encourage people to go out and wild gather, because as it is for Native Americans, California Indians in particular, don't have a natural right to gather. That was lost, of course. And because California Indians are not treaty tribes, they are tribes by executive order. There was no treaty in place for any of the tribes at the time that they were recognized to gather their native materials and their native foods to hunt. As a matter of fact, out of all the tribes in the United States, only a few that do have treaty tribes include the gathering of their native foods and materials. So what we have to do is we have to work with the entities that control those resources, like the federal parks, the state parks, and we have to get permits. And the permits, like with the other permits that are sometimes issued, it's only for personal use. We're not allowed to take entire plants. And because it's a long tradition in our families, we make sure that the plant's going to be there next year, and we do know how to do that. Some of the information has been lost through, you know, through the historic circumstances, but most of the stuff we do know, and there's a lot of competition because of the dwindling of our resources, our land, to gather our materials. There's a lot of competition between the Native people that do go out and gather. And many of us actually, there's a number of people actually gather for elders and others who can't get out there. So we do have a lot of these issues. I liked when someone said that they encourage to eat the invasives, because that is something we really encourage, because that is really a problem everywhere. And some of the invasives are very nutritious, like the mustard. And we know that people used to do that a long time ago. Italian Americans used to go out and gather the mustard. It used to be kind of kept in check, but now not too many people do that, and it's pretty much a serious problem.
That's very interesting to hear how this movement fits into this whole tradition that comes from Native people, and to understand that you also have a hard time with access and you know, have the same challenges that you know, the foragers out there have.
Actually, I think we have more of a difficult time, and the reason is because I guess we just are automatically told of our boundaries. We know what the BLM wants from us. We know what the federal parks, we know state parks, local parks, whether they even allow any access or not. Certainly private land is you know, very dangerous to try to gather on sometimes. And the experiences, especially what comes to mind is some of our basket weavers having very difficult times, even with park rangers. You get a new park ranger who doesn't know the rules, doesn't know the people. It's very difficult, I guess, too, because of the, if you're out in the woods and you're gathering stuff, sometimes you get somebody who doesn't know, and they don't really know the plants, and they might think you're gathering some illegal kind of thing. And so we've run into that. We've had basket weavers had guns pulled on them because they were gathering something that was obviously not marijuana, for example, having guns pulled on it. So it's one of those things we know very well, and we don't encourage even tribal members. You have some people from certain tribes will say they're not going to adhere to the rules, and they'll take their chances. But most of us rather not, come face to face with, the park rangers, et cetera, in a bad way. We try to develop good relationships. And some of the parks have, in their regions, they have liaisons who work with the tribes, and that sometimes works really wonderfully. And then there are other times we get people who have no interest in working with Native people and make it as hard as possible.
Okay, thanks so much, Rose. I just wondered, Sasha, do you have any comment on that? It sounds like a lot of your work kind of is so connected to this sort of movement with
the Alaska Weavers. Yeah, and that's actually one of the reasons why particularly with my students and with Permaculture Institute, we focus on invasives and weeds and waste because, it's kind of looking at the whole systems and trying again to get people to think about the whole system of activities. And for poor example, we do a project surrounding weeds and wardrobes too, so we combine the two with community gardens and call them Weed Your Wardrobes, where people bring in clothing they don't want and also weed a garden and use those weeds to then dye the clothing they don't want to have renewed value to them. And so it's just kind of putting forth alternatives for people who do want to have that nature connection, and also thinking about ways that it might actually benefit a community or mm-hmm. a land base instead of taking from it. Or
I love that idea of turning the idea of a weed on its head, that it's a positive thing.
Yeah.
And I know, Kevin, you talked about that too. Weeds are edible. Weeds could be clothes,
mm-hmm.
We have a caller on the line. I wanted to see if GS was there.
Yes, thank you. I'm still here.
Thank you for calling City Visions.
Thank you, guys. The wisdom that surrounds you folks is just incredible. I feel like such a pedestrian. But anyway, I have been a high-tech person, lived in Silicon Valley, and once when a startup I was with failed, I went from a $1,500 a month apartment to a tent in a field across the street. I've been a vegetarian since about 1970 or so, and pretty much anywhere in California, I'm being a little redundant here, but mustard plants grow. You can eat the leaves. You can eat the flowers. You just don't want to take off the branches or pull up the roots. You can eat dandelion flowers, which grow in anybody's front yard if they don't, pick the weeds. But anyway, you should ask the people, but if you're quick about it, nobody really minds if you weed their lawn for them. Again, you pick the leaves. You can eat the leaves. You can eat the flowers. They have those wonderful little puffs, little white spherical puffs you can blow at and spread the seeds all over the place and make it better for next year. And finally, number three, the only thing about doing your foraging in a civilized area is you need to be aware of the possibility of herbicides and pesticides mm-hmm. being used on your lawn. So you got to be real careful about that. And you can eat seaweed too, but you wouldn't want to try to find it in the San Francisco Bay, and you need a sailboat to go a couple hundred miles out. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Thanks so much. Or Gigi, thanks for the call. I want to just give you our number again. If there's any other listeners who are out there who've had also experiences with foraging, we'd love to hear about them. Our number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Our caller just brought up something I want to get to next, which is the ethics and safety of foraging. And, there's that old saying, there's old mushroom pickers and bold mushroom pickers, right? But there's no old, bold mushroom pickers. So, there's the poison, literally, that can be out there that someone could pick and eat, and then there's the pesticide issues, right? And especially if we're talking about non-native species weeds, that's often something somebody's trying to kill. So it might have something on it that if you're turning it into a shirt, it might be okay. But if you're going to eat it for dinner, it might not be okay. So I guess I'm curious about how you educate the people in your classes and your students. And, what do you do about helping people understand how to stay safe when they're doing this? And maybe, Kevin, I'll start with you.
Okay. I always start my classes with what I call the bad news. and illegality being part of that. And the other being pollution is a real concern. So I heard you say earlier, you know, eat the weeds that are growing in the median of the road. I do not advise that. Roadsides, parking lots, anywhere near most buildings and structures, anytime there's runoff from anything toxic, which in the urban environment is most places, toxins can accumulate in the soil, and then the plants can absorb those toxins, and you eat those plants, and then you can get toxicity to develop in your body. So you need to be really careful about where you pick. You know, there's no surefire way other than laboratory testing to find out for sure, but you typically want to avoid areas that don't accumulate a lot of runoff. So urban creeks and streams and things like that are a no-no for the most part for foraging. Another thing to keep people safe is that seeds, flowers, and fruit will typically absorb less poison from the soil than leafy parts of the plant or roots. So that makes certain things a little bit safer to do, even if it is near a road, like citrus growing out of a side of a sidewalk or something like that is typically okay, a lot more so than lettuce that would be growing underneath it in the same sidewalk, for instance. Herbicides is a real problem, and I wanted to talk about this earlier. Those same parks that don't allow the foraging of anything, that includes the invasive plants that grow there. And, you know, where I'm at in a lot of places near and around the Bay Area, I would say 95% of all the plants in a certain area are all considered to be invasive. There are very few native plants around, especially in the open space and grassland areas. You know, where I hike regularly, it's almost all invasive or non-native plants. But we're not allowed to forage for those, but the parks are allowed to spray herbicides on them, which happens a lot. And because they don't have a regular regimen of it, it's hard to know whether they were sprayed last year. Sometimes they're not sprayed every year. Sometimes they're sprayed in random places. So it's a real concern when they spray, especially the combo Roundup is what's typically done in parks because it's not food approved, you know, so they're a lot harsher and more dangerous. You know, typically you can tell if herbicides have been sprayed because the plants die. If there's just, you know, yellowing plants for no reason, then that's a sign that herbicides have been sprayed there. One thing that is especially dangerous is they like to target blackberries with herbicides in many parks. And, you know, trail sides and, you know, any open space, whether it be city parks or whatever, county, you know, regional. And they'll spray them with herbicides, but the blackberries are so tough that they don't die off necessarily from that herbicide application. And blackberries are the number one thing that children and families just regularly forage for. I mean, that's something that just is human nature, and it's always been done. People, oh, look, blackberries. I'm going to, you know, gather a basket and go home and make something. Well, they could have just got a healthy dose of, you know, of dangerous herbicides sprayed on them, and you won't know, which, you know, really kind of bothers me because not only are they, you know, spraying herbicides to poison the general environment, but, you know, poisoning children, families, and foragers that are picking those, but it doesn't even achieve their goal of killing the blackberry.
Okay, that's a great point, and I think everyone listening maybe take a note of that because I know my kids have picked those blackberries along the side of the road. I want to just jump in for a minute. We have a caller, Nick from San Francisco. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for calling City Visions Radio.
Hi, I'm sorry, I'm kind of off on a tangent. I'm really liking this idea about invasives and picking, and I have a specific question. Is there a use for textiles for something, say, like Scotch broom? And could it even be created on such a level, if there is a use for Scotch broom and coloring, that could be done on a much more larger commercial scale, perhaps, to really rid ourselves of such a really invasive plant?
Okay, it's a great question. Yeah. We are running out of time, so maybe we'll make it a fairly brief answer.
Well, your brief answer is yes, and that yes translates to yellows and greens, and it's beautiful color, and my students work with it, and I work with it quite often, and in terms of translating to the industrial level, it is also something that I think, you know, in terms of it's just having that knowledge and then experimenting and communicating onto the next levels to see what may be possible.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the call, Nick. And I just wanted to give us some time. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left to give Sasha and Kevin a chance to kind of look towards the future. And we've heard, we've gotten some great information tonight about foraging. And I know I've got a whole new sense of what this whole movement's about and all the different ways and people are doing it in a way that can really help the environment. And so I just wanted to see, you know, what do you think the future is going to look like? If you could look 10 years down the road, what do you think it's going to look like for foraging in the Bay Area? Sasha, I'll quickly go to you and then and Kevin.
Well, my hope is that there will just be a lot more of a deepened knowledge of what plants can provide and how humans can work with those plants. And that would be a whole way of looking at food, medicine, and clothing, shelter, even too, all of these different ways that one might be putting into production what currently may be causing pollution, even in an urban environment.
Do you think we'll see clothes made out of scotch broom for sale at Target?
Hopefully not at Target, but you may from your local independent designer, and you may see it in other encouraging and inspiring ways. So.
Okay, thank you. What about Kevin? What about you? What do you see down the road?
Well, that's a question I don't think we have time to answer. So I'll focus on something specific.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to see in the upcoming years with the food foraging movement to have permits given out from parks, like you would get a fishing license, in which certain species within certain limits are available to forage at certain times of the year, just like it is with hunting or fishing. And, you know, you would have your permit to say, oh, I can come and take, you know, this much miner's lettuce, you know, during this week at this park, and, you know, and pay your annual dues for your license or whatnot, and it's nobody has any problems with it, and it all works out. On the other hand, you know, the parks might have something like, you know, all the thistles you want, dig them up, you know, pull them out, do whatever you want with the thistles. You know, unlimited, kind of like boar are in the hunting world. There's not as many limits, if any, really, on the hunting of wild boar in a lot of places. So it seems like a pretty, you know, simple fix when there's already models there for that. And I think that would just go a long way in giving the foragers access and bringing people back into their local food sheds in a real way and not just sort of this idyllic system that we have now, you know, where foraging means going out far into the woods and finding, you know, rare mushrooms.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kevin. I love that vision where we would actually have a system for being able to do it and people could take care of the land at the same time they're looking for really interesting food to eat and clothes to make. I wanted to thank you both so much for being on the show tonight. This is City Visions for this evening. We had Kevin Feinstein, naturalist, educator, and co-author of The Bay Area Forager. We had Sasha Dewar, professor, author, and founder of the Permaculture Institute. Thank you all for joining me for this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, you can go to our website at klw.org and search for City Visions. Our engineer tonight was Eric Wayne. Our tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denemark. Thank you, Lisa. Great job. City Vision's senior producer is Susan Britton. Join us next week when City Visions explores the impact of federal immigration reform in the Bay Area. This is Victoria Thorpe. Thanks for listening to City Visions on KALW, your local public radio station. Good night and have a great week.